I'm Christopher Lydon, pulling together stateside impressions of this year of India with the engaged sociologist Patrick Heller at Brown. Before we plunge ourselves into the subcontinent in the monsoon season this summer, this is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. We've been sampling the views of the emergent capitalist nuclear superpower democracy, the new India, with Mahatma Gandhi's grandson and eminences from Arundhati Roy, the novelist, the goddess of small things, I call her, to Amartya Sen, the economist, to Suketu Mehta, the historian of Bombay, to Rana Dasgupta, novelist, journalist. But what about the social, scientific, outside students of India, of whom Patrick Heller is an avid example? Patrick, start with you. How does a young social scientist get hooked on India in the first place? What was your story?
As I think is true of most social scientists, you get hooked through personal histories. You know, we'd like to think of ourselves as posing big questions and then going out and looking for the relevant data. But I think most research is ultimately driven by personal biography. And in my case, my family picked up and moved to India when I was 16. And like any other 16-year-old who'd grown up, primarily I'm originally from Switzerland, and at the time we were living in France, so I'd grown up in the West with, you know, all its relative luxuries and privileges. And to move at 16 from, we lived in southern France at the time, to New Delhi, and this is back in the late 70s before the big economic takeoff, and before India had opened itself to world markets and world culture. So India was still very much a highly insulated economy and not as penetrated as it is today by Western consumer products and Western culture, et cetera. And so it was a quite dramatic transition for a 16-year-old.
This was emergency time, Indira Gandhi?
Just after. She had actually just been reelected. So Indira, you know, called the emergency. There was a huge reaction against it. She held elections. She lost. She was defeated by a motley coalition of various political parties. Then a few years later, that coalition fell apart and Indira was eventually reelected. So by the time we got to India in 79, she was actually the prime minister again.
So what made you a lifelong India guy as opposed to just a teenager? What is it?
Well, you know, all the exotic stereotypes about India are stereotypes, but there's a lot of truth to them. So the place is extraordinarily intense. It's dense. The poverty, the destitution, the human degradation are, for someone arriving from Europe, absolutely shocking. And unlike, say, in China, where you have an authoritarian regime that's been able to control urbanization and that can hide poverty, or South Africa, another country that I know well, where apartheid was extremely good at hiding the poverty, at secluding the poor in townships and informal settlements. In India, poverty is everywhere. It's a democracy, and so you can't just clear out the poor. You can't just clear out the slums, and the poor are an integral part of every aspect, every dimension of Indian life, and there's nothing hidden about poverty in India, especially back in 79, where the differences of lifestyle and privilege weren't nearly as pronounced as they are today. So everything was that much more visible. And then there's the heat and there's the extraordinary color and vivaciousness of Indian life, public life in particular, the multiplicity of religions, identities, ethnicities, the extraordinary range of political perspectives, right? So, you know, India has, I lose count of the number of communist parties, right? So the diversity is just extraordinary, and it's absolutely overwhelming.
You know, India always reminds me of that line, Ezra Pound's line, that if all the music we had in the world was Johann Sebastian Bach, we'd have enough. And if all the literature we had in the world was Homer, just the Iliad and the Odyssey, we'd have enough. Men, women, war, peace, drama, etc. I often think there's so many varieties of India. If all the people we had on the planet were Indians, we'd have enough.
I think that's true. I mean, I always say that about Indian food, right? If I had to give up every cuisine in the world, the one cuisine I couldn't give up is Indian because of just the extraordinary variety. And so it was a kind of, you know, ethnographic experience, right? But just as a 16-year-old traveling around on a really limited budget. And then I left and went on to, you know, college and got interested in sociology for various reasons. And it was actually only as a graduate student that I decided to study India. India is attractive to most people because it's culturally exotic. And I think that's actually one of the problems with the way the West has engaged with India, is that most of the engagement is an engagement with India the exotic. You know, the India of Hinduism, of Buddhism, the India of these great, wonderful civilizational traditions, the India of extraordinary food and linguistic and musical diversity, the India of all the extraordinary cultural and religious and other practices. And all that's very real and fascinating, and we should be engaged with it. But India is obviously, of course, the world's largest democracy. It's the world's most, I think, extraordinary experiment in democracy. Extraordinary because it was a democracy built on a social base that was one, the most unequal and the most poor social base that any democracy has ever inherited, right? So democracy usually comes after a certain level of economic development. At least that's the history of democracy in the West. Well, democracy came to India when India was an overwhelmingly peasant, illiterate, and extraordinarily poor society. So that in and of itself is unique. And secondly, this democracy was built on an edifice of the most culturally diverse and heterogeneous social material of any society. I mean, some would dispute that and say China's more diverse. I think India is culturally, ethnically, linguistically probably the most diverse society in the world. And again, this defies all the sort of conventional assumptions about when and how you can build a democracy. Usually, we assume that democracies are built in consolidated nations where people have a shared national history and identity. Whereas when India became a democracy, it was a multiplicity of nations, of different linguistic regions, of hundreds of principalities, maharajas. And all that had to be integrated into one single nation. And the great success of Indian democracy has been the fact that it has been able to build the nation. It's had many other shortcomings and has many deficits and challenges, but its one truly extraordinary success has been molding this extraordinary heterogeneity and a billion people into a single nation.
Yeah, the order of it is important. I read your book on Kerala, the state in the south, where, as you say, over a century, the order of things was first the mobilization of unprivileged classes, then the development of a democracy in independence, and then the development of a more equal economy than we associate either with India or, for that matter, most of the world. Do you want to talk about why Kerala is a critical example?
Kerala is very different than other Indian states, right? They've been able to provide for mass education, and so they have almost 100% literacy. They've been able to provide low-end but very effective access to universal health care, and which explains why the infant mortality level is so low and why life expectancy is high. The fertility rates have come way down, and most people believe that's because women in Kerala are literate, and so they know how to use birth control, and they know how to say no. They know what their rights are. There's high levels of unionization. There's a quite well-organized civil society. But what always struck me about Kerala is just how different it was from other Indian states. And so it occurred to me that there was a lot of social science things to be learned from a careful study of Kerala. For example, where does this successful trajectory of social development come from?
Mention also the extremely rigid caste distinctions historically in Kerala.
Yeah. to me, and you know, and people will disagree on what really explains Kerala and just how different it is. But something I think no one disagrees on is just how much it's changed. And it went from, and most accounts on this are very clear, probably having the most extreme, the most exploitative caste system in India. So famously, untouchables, as they used to be called, now they're called Dalits, had to keep a distance of 27 feet from the higher castes. Untouchable women could not cover their breasts. Untouchable men could not have facial hair. And of course, they were limited to occupations like working with leather or dealing with excrement, etc. So menial laboring positions. And throughout the caste hierarchy in Kerala, the boundaries were extraordinarily rigid. And anthropologists and social commentators from the 1880s, 1890s have all described this as a madhouse, famously, as one of the most egregious examples of the caste system in all of India. And Kerala, moreover, was densely one of the most densely populated parts of India and extremely poor. Right. And, you know, the data from the 1880s is not all that reliable, but we know it was one of the more, quote, backward parts of India. And today it has the highest literacy rates. It's growing. It's actually growing quite a little bit faster than the rest of India, which is quite striking. And if you go to Kerala, the first thing that strikes you compared to any other part of India is how good the infrastructure is. You know, there's a post office in every village. There's access to computers in every village. The most remote areas have modern infrastructure. And so for a sociologist, what was striking more than anything else is just how much and how dramatically things could change. Because we tend to assume that poor places stay poor, rich places stay rich. We tend to assume that inequality is difficult to get rid of. We tend to assume that the past weighs heavily on the present, that the obstacles to development, when they're really in place, things like the caste system or extreme inequality or patriarchy, are really hard to budge or really hard to move. And what Kerala illustrates for me, and there are other cases in the world, Costa Rica might be another good example, where you can get this extraordinary reversal of the social order. So today, the chief minister of Kerala, which is the equivalent of a governor in the United States, is a Dalit. And he was an agricultural laborer. And he came up through politics, through the Union of Landless Laborers. And today, he's the governor, you know, and the party in power, the CPM, which is a communist party, its social base is a caste called the Iravas, who are not untouchables, but they're very low in the hierarchy. And, you know, Kerala is famous for its redistribution and land reform and provisioning for the poor, et cetera. So a real reversal of the traditional privileges enjoyed by the upper caste groups at the turn of the century.
These were so-called princely states, as I remember, under British rule. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, what did the Brits, what did independence of India from 47 on have to do with the change? And what marks the turning point?
If you had to pinpoint a date, it would be when Kerala holds its first elections, and I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I think it's 1954, and the communists are elected to power. And this is significant on a number of fronts. I mean, first of all, it's the first time in the world anywhere that a party calling itself a communist party is actually elected to power. So this got a lot of attention in the global media, got a lot of attention from the CIA. A lot of people thought this was the beginning of the end for democracy in India, you know, communists coming to power. But these were communists who had very clearly stated their commitment to what they called the parliamentary route to power, right? So they were committed to parliamentary democracy. That was clearly the electoral moment that shifted everything. But, of course, there's a whole history behind that moment. And that history in and of itself is fascinating, but I think there's really two distinct phases to it. The first phase is really a caste reform movement. So you have a lot of lower caste groups, Iravas, untouchables, etc., who start to mobilize already in the 1890s, but it accelerates in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s. And they mobilize around a whole range of issues. They want access to education. But the most famous movement is the temple entry movement. That is, these caste groups were not allowed in temples that were largely the preserves of upper castes, and they demanded access. And Mahatma Gandhi actually took part in some of these demonstrations. And so you have this very explicit challenge to the caste system and demands by lower caste groups to be part of the public. But at the same time, you begin to have peasant movements. So peasants in the northern part of the state, Malabar, which was not Maharajas, this was a part of the Madras colony still governed directly by the British. There, the demand was for land reform. So tenants wanted land. It was very simple. And in the southern part of the state, it was landless laborers who wanted minimum wages, they wanted unions, they wanted to be treated properly. And so in the context of the anti-colonial movement, it was easy to also mobilize against the landlords. And you had this almost perfect storm of the agrarian land reform movement coming together with the anti-caste movement, coming together with the anti-colonial movement. And it's that movement that the eventual Communist Party rode to power.
So many little suggestive links there to, you know, unionization or religious freedom movements or civil rights movements or women's movements in other parts of the world. But in India, what drives this kind of change?
Well, I think the answer to that is everything. I'm serious in the sense that – and India in this sense is this extraordinary juxtaposition. There's a well-known political theorist in India, Pratap Mehta, who in a recent book opens with a well-known joke in India that cricket is an Indian game that happens to have been invented in England.
Yeah.
And he says the same thing about democracy, right? So democracy is an Indian institution that happens to have been invented in Britain.
It's a universal game that just
exactly. But in India, it's played Indian style, right? So there's this extraordinary juxtaposition of very Indian discourses. Some of them are religious, some are spiritual, some have other sources. Amartya Sen has famously argued that Indians, or at least Indian elites, have a long tradition of argumentative politics, of engaging each other on public issues. So this idea of a public sphere, these Habermasian notions of a public sphere and deliberation, there's nothing European about that. I mean, India has a long tradition of this. Mm. It's true that it was largely a privileged sphere, but then that was true in Europe as well up until the mass democracy movements of the 1920s. But in India, what you get really is this convergence of all these indigenous traditions of argumentation and deliberation and mobilization. And of course, you know, Mahatma Gandhi was the great social movement entrepreneur of the 20th century, right? Yeah. I mean, he invented the modern social movement with its various tactics, its repertoires of contention, civil disobedience, the Long March, the boycotts, etc. I've always said it's actually a mistake to talk about Indian democracy. We should talk about Indian democracies. Mm-hmm. Because every Indian state literally has its own its own parties. Different parties rule in different states. Politics in India are very regional, or very much right. State in the sense of Kerala, Tamil Nadu, Bihar, etc. And the results are very different.
What's the furthest contrast you can imagine in India between Kerala and
Bihar.
Someplace else?
Yeah, Bihar is famously where there's the highest rates of poverty, there's a lot of violence, where the caste system is still very much in place, where landlords mobilize private armies to repress landless laborers. Recently, there's been some interesting developments in Bihar. The politics have changed. There's even been a little bit of economic growth. But it's still generally, along with the neighboring states of UP and Madhya Pradesh and Rajasthan, those four states are generally considered to be the most underdeveloped economically and socially. And, I would argue that there's probably more difference between Bihar and Kerala than there is between, say, Sweden and Greece. And yet we never treat them as separate entities. We always talk about Indian democracy or Indian development or Indian capitalism or Indian social development. But the variation within India is absolutely extraordinary. And social scientists are only really beginning to look at this. And there's so much to be learned. So Bihar is one extreme where the state's just absent. And then at the other extreme, Kerala, where the vast majority of babies are born in clinics or hospitals, whereas most births in Bihar aren't even registered in the public record.
Patrick Heller, come to 2010, 20 years into the capitalist transformation of India. Kerala is still poor. The democracy is lumpy, shall we say, but real. What are you studying? What are you learning about India in Kerala? What are you comparing it to? Where do you see the vectors pointing into what could still become the Indian century?
Right, right. Well, big question, huge question. And I like that phrase, lumpy democracy. That's terrific. I have to remember that one. Well, look, so yes, India's made a transition. It's an extraordinary transition, double-digit growth now for at least a decade and a lot of growth before that. And just the sheer accumulation of wealth is absolutely unprecedented. It's important we think about this in comparative terms. So the obvious comparison is with China. And then we also think again of the variation within India, because the growth pattern is quite regionally specific. And so these high growth rates have had very different implications for different parts of the country. And I'm always interested in the question of how all of this is being mediated. That is, it's terrific to have new wealth, but the question is always, how is that wealth being distributed? Is it, to use that infamous phrase, trickling down, or to be a little bit more social scientific about it, is it having multiplier effects, linkages? And secondly, is the rate of change itself having other effects that we need to be worried about? So to begin on the growth question, you know, people keep comparing India and China. And besides the fact that they both have double-digit growth and they're both countries with a billion-plus people, there's otherwise almost nothing in common with those growth rates. The growth in China has been more regionally distributed, and it has had more, I think, poverty-reducing effects than in India, in large part because it's had more linkages. So a lot of the growth has, for example, benefited rural areas and township enterprises and things of that sort. There's lots of inequality in China, and there's a lot of poverty. But still, I think in general the growth has had broader, more inclusive effects than is true in India, in part because China dealt with basic reforms before it started on its growth trajectory. So they had land reform. They broke up these vast concentrations of land, and they had basic social development, right? They got literacy rates up. They got people educated. They expanded health services. Now, a lot of those services have since deteriorated, but at least they started with a much better social base, whereas India is starting on what is still a very poor social base, right? So very high levels of illiteracy. 47% of Indian children still, after two decades of sustained rapid growth, suffer from malnutrition. 47%. I mean, it's unbelievable. And this is a huge sample, very reliable data. So we have to recognize that this growth is certainly a good thing, but what are the effects of that growth? What are the multiplier effects? And so far, they haven't been that great. The growth has been concentrated in a few sectors: IT, finance, services, some manufacturing, although not a lot. It's largely been jobless growth. That is, it's created jobs, but in sectors that are not very labor intensive. And in fact, most of the jobs it's created are in sectors that are very knowledge intensive, which means that it's absorbing or it's hiring people who are highly educated, who tend to be upper caste, English speaking urban dwellers, right? So it's not really benefiting the smallholder farmer or the landless laborer. And that's half your population of India right there.
It's the majority even in Kerala, no?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. It's the majority in Kerala, although in Kerala, a lot of people, because so many people have had access to education, they either migrate out a lot to the Middle East and other parts of India. And then their remittances, they bring money back, and Kerala is benefiting from that. And even within Kerala, there's been a lot of growth in areas like tourism, which tend to be a bit more not – you have to be savvy about tourism and culture and things of that sort and running your own business. So Kerala has been able to at least capitalize on its historical investments in education, whereas other states just don't have that educational base to capitalize on.
What's the net of all those trends, and especially seen from the perspective of a socially progressive state like Kerala?
I would say that there's been growth, but it's not been inclusive, and that's problematic. And that the key now is finding ways to either – or actually ideally two things – to make the growth itself more widespread and more inclusive so that it has more linkages to other sectors and other regions and into rural areas and becomes more labor intensive. But also, to be blunt, to tax some of that wealth in order to provide for the social services that are still so miserably lacking throughout most of India.
But that's not taboo in India the way it is in this country, for example, is it?
Well, that's right. I think as a discourse, it's not as taboo as it is in the United States. So in the United States, taxing is unthinkable, et cetera. No politician wants to stick their neck out and say we need to tax, even though it's obvious we need to tax more given the deficit. In India, you can get away with saying that. It's still okay to say we're going to spend on social programs, et cetera. The problem in India is that with growth has come the increasing power of business groups. And business groups obviously don't want to be taxed. Indian politics, like politics anywhere in the world, need money. Where's that money coming from? Well, it's coming from business groups. It's coming from land speculation. It's coming from all the new growth in the economy. And so to a large extent, politicians and the state are increasingly beholden to business groups. Manishankar Iyer, who was for a long time the minister of Panchayati Raj in India and responsible for all local government. There's over 500,000 local governments in India, which is really where a lot of the work of development needs to be done. He complained bitterly that his budget was less than the budget for the Commonwealth Games. Now, the Commonwealth Games are being held in India as we speak. They required a lot of infrastructure development in Delhi. But for one sporting event to require more funding than support for all of India's 500,000 local governments tells you a little bit about where the government's priorities are, right?
Yeah.
And they like the Commonwealth Games because it'll have a global audience. They'll be able to show off Delhi's new infrastructure, et cetera. So it's seen as being, you know, good for the image of India and for attracting investors, et cetera. But still, that's a pretty warped set of priorities, right? And so this is the political economy problem, right? There's growth, but there isn't really either the political will or the political coalitions required to capture some of that growth and reinvest it in services and infrastructure and education, et cetera. With one notable exception, and I think it should be highlighted, namely that over the past few years, India, at the behest of the current government, has introduced something called the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme. It's a horrible acronym, NREGS. But this is a very ambitious anti-poverty program. There was a lot of resistance to it, but a lot of people in Delhi felt that they had to do something to stimulate employment in rural areas. And so the government is financing basically rural work programs that are specifically targeted to the poor. And some of the research we've seen suggests that this is already having a quite dramatic impact on poor people's livelihoods in rural areas.
Patrick, I want to come back to that global branding of India. But first, you do comparative work between India and South Africa, between Kerala and Durban specifically. What does that tell you in terms of making a mark in development and democracy?
These are all democracies. I've done a little work on Brazil as well. So these are Brazil, South Africa, India. These are three large, arguably the largest democracies in the global south. But the question that emerges is, can these democracies deliver on substantive things like services? Can the state really be made more accountable? Can the state provide those things that most people agree modern states need to provide? education, good infrastructure. And that's an open-ended question.
But roughly speaking, on those scales, how's India doing?
On that scale, India's not doing that well. As I said, Indian democracy has consolidated the nation, which is an extraordinary achievement in and of itself. But in terms of making government and politicians accountable, Indian democracy has not been that successful, right? So I don't like the term corruption so much, but the way in which politicians abuse public resources for largely political ends in India is endemic. You know, Rajiv Gandhi, the former prime minister, once famously said that out of every rupee, only 5 paisa or 5 cents actually gets to the people. In other words, that from the government down to the people it's supposed to benefit, there's so much siphoning off of public funds that almost nothing. And in that respect, democracy has been a failure. In other simple respects, like ensuring the rule of law. So elites abuse the system constantly, and they get away with it all the time. Mm-hmm. So from little things like beating up a domestic worker to exploiting child labor to denying women access to public spaces, those sorts of fundamental constraints on basic democratic freedoms, et cetera, are still quite pervasive throughout India. And then we can get into the question of caste and all the various inequalities associated with the caste system. So, Muslims in India, a huge Muslim community, are still discriminated against. They're more likely to end up in prison. They're more likely to not be offered a job. They're more likely to live in a poor slum, et cetera. So those kinds of problems are still absolutely endemic and seemingly intractable in India, which is, again, why I'm always so interested in places like Kerala and Tamil Nadu, because those are the exceptions, right, where they have done something to address some of these important social questions.
Come back to the very general branding of India. What do you think of as the essential India value added in a global mind?
There's no doubt that India has come to occupy a really extraordinary and unique niche in the global economy, right? So in a very short period of time, it's scaled up in its capacity to export things to the global. So, you know, back in the 1970s when I first went to India, India couldn't export a thing. It couldn't produce much of anything that was competitive in global markets. And today, when it comes to a wide range of services, all services that are tied to the information economy and global IT infrastructure, you know, whether it's actual development of software or providing financial services or medical services or pretty much anything that can be delivered across the internet.
Call centers on
call up, sort of centers thing. Or, you know, doctors examining x-rays or engineers looking at blueprints, all of these things that have been outsourced, these fundamental forms of knowledge production that can be outsourced and transmitted across the internet. India has become the competitor, right? I mean, it is in terms of wage costs, but it's not just wage competition. For a while, that's where its competitive advantage was, right? I mean, it was Indian software engineers were just cheaper than anywhere else. But now they're just better at it than anyone else. I mean, they do it faster. They do it more efficiently. They work around 24-hour clock. They can deliver just in time. They're innovative. It used to be that they were just doing what other people asked them to do. So they were quite far down the value chain. But now they're doing the proprietary stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Developing the new software, not just doing the coding, developing new ways of organizing inventories or backroom services, et cetera. So in all those sectors, in some ways, India represents the new economy and is at the leading edge of that new economy. And this is true of biotechnology as well, right? So India's generic drugs production and its pharmaceutical industry is one of the most competitive in the world now. Which is why, by the way, India was more than happy to join the WTO and sign agreements, something they wouldn't have thought of doing 20 years ago, because now they know they're absolutely competitive and they want to be able to penetrate global markets and get their generic drugs out there and start developing their own drugs and get those patented, et cetera. So I think in some ways, even more so than China, Because China's doing a lot of these things as well. But China mostly started off and still is dominant in the manufacturing sector, which is still the old economy. That's the 20th century economy. The 21st century economy is a knowledge industry economy. And that's where India's absolutely at the cutting edge. But, you know, where you get a real disjuncture. And, you know, so it's easy to get very excited about this. And, you know, Tom Friedman now declares the earth is flat. And reports constantly from Bangalore, and you go to Bangalore and there's these extraordinary industrial parks where Infosys and others are located, and they're at the cutting edge of the global economy, and people are walking around in jeans and drinking Coca-Cola and, you know, listening to rap, and, you know, they're more connected to Los Angeles than they are to the rural areas of Karnataka, the state in which Bangalore is located. Where you see the disjuncture and the disarticulation is precisely in a place like Bangalore. So Bangalore is the poster child of the new IT economy. But if you look at the patterns of hiring in Bangalore, most of the hiring is still in the upper caste groups, right? So the groups that are benefiting from these new employment opportunities, these new consumption patterns, et cetera, are, again, urban, English-speaking, upper caste groups for the most part. And there's good research on this. Secondly, Bangalore is growing and glowing. Bangalore is a city in a state. The state's called Karnataka, and I forget what the population of Karnataka is, but I'm pretty sure it's over 60 million, right? So we're talking roughly the equivalent of France. The rest of Karnataka is not doing well. Rural Karnataka is still extraordinarily poor, and in fact, it still has one of the highest poverty rates of all the southern states. So Bangalore is taking off. It's shining. It's growing. It's at the epicenter of the global economy. It's a global city linked and articulated into the global economy. And in rural Bangalore, you have stagnation, you have poverty. And some people argue, and I think there's probably some truth to this, the two are actually connected in that Bangalore is attracting all the resources, including public resources. So a lot of public monies are going into building the new infrastructure for the Infosys of the world, for this new IT economy. And that's money that's not going into building wells or primary schools in rural Karnataka, right? So there are trade-offs.
Patrick, you've been at the center of this Year of India at Brown. Writers, journalists, statesmen, the head of Infosys himself parading through. Fascinating variety. What did you learn in this Year of India?
Well, a number of things. First, that it's time that we mainstream India, that for too long we've treated India both culturally but also in terms of its politics as something exotic, as an outlier. That's India. It's different. What's striking to me now is that because of its economic prowess, because of the way India has burst upon the global economic scene, we can't now just treat India as something exotic. India is now, you know, you pick up the phone and you make a call to get some help with a credit card and you're actually talking to someone in India, right? So it's no longer just this faraway place. It's present in our lives. But everyone also agrees that the challenges of Indian democracy are extraordinary, the ones that we've been talking about. And then, the other thing to come back to the point about mainstreaming India is that the more we learn about India and Indian democracy, the more we're going to understand about democracy in general. That rather than always trying to see Indian democracy through the frame of what American or European democracies look like, maybe now we can sort of reverse the analytic logic and start asking ourselves, what does American democracy look like through Indian lenses?
So many insights in this past year. The one that sticks with me is Rana Dasgupta, himself born in England, gone back home to his father's country, and now an authoritative novelist and journalistic observer. But his point was that they're so much like us in many, many ways. They're immediately comfortable coming into our culture. They'll be thoroughly able competitors at the kind of American enterprise. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. But to be quite concrete about it, I think there's three things going on here. One is language, right? So Indian elites speak great English. They're well-versed in literature, et cetera. So in terms of, quote, cultural capital, they're extremely well-equipped and much better equipped than, say, their Chinese or Brazilian counterparts. And right there, that's a huge advantage, which is, of course, part of the explanation for why India's done so well in this niche of outsourcing services and the knowledge industry, et cetera, because you want to speak to operators who are fluent in English. So that's one advantage. The other is they know democracy. Democracy is in their blood. They've practiced it for 60 years. Some would say they've done a better job of it, and they've been more innovative. So they understand the rule of law. They understand basic liberal ideas of pluralism, of deliberation, of engagement, of respecting certain fundamental rights. And third, they know capitalism. One of, I think, the greatest misconceptions about the economic reforms. So the sort of standard history of it is that, up until the reforms, which started roughly in 1991, India was this closed, quasi-socialist, heavily planned economy in the Nehruvian vision of planned development. And it was certainly closed. That's true. So there were high tariff barriers, and you didn't see many Indian products, non-Indian products in India. It was sort of planned, but not very well planned. Again, the flailing state. So at the top, it was well planned, but this never really reached down. And economists in particular say, well, the state was micromanaging everything. And yeah, it was micromanaging some sectors. But to this day, 91% of India's economy is in the so-called informal or unorganized sector. That is, it's not subject to any laws or any regulations. It's the free market. I mean, Indians have been engaging in commercial activity and innovation and enterprise for a long, long time. Of course, this is a history that goes back millennia, arguably. But in the modern era, India's always been a vibrant market capitalist economy. It's true there was a lot of regulation at the top. It's true that some sectors were state-dominated. But in most of the economy, and anyone who's actually traveled to India and seen a real market, be it a labor market or a vegetable market or a market for just about any imaginable good, knows that this is not communist China or even Europe. It's totally unregulated. It's totally free enterprise, et cetera. So the culture and practices of free enterprise and capitalism are in the blood of Indian entrepreneurial elites. So this idea that we could export entrepreneurial knowledge to India, to me, is just it's just a new kind of Orientalism. That they know democracy, and they don't know it from the books. They know it from the practice of democracy, and it's part of their culture and their politics and their institutions, and then the cultural advantage of speaking English. So in that sense, I think Indian elites, be they academics, intellectuals, novelists, or entrepreneurs, they're just really good at exporting themselves. And my favorite anecdote here is the new Indian Cricket League.
Overnight.
The Indian Premier League, which is this new cricket league that emerged on a new format, a shortened cricket format. Huge business success, massive business success, cultural success as well, incredible attendance. And a year ago—
Not to mention television rights.
Television rights. So, this is NFL style, right? They got it all, including cheerleaders. They actually brought cheerleaders from the U.S. So in terms of marketing, branding— everything. This was, they outdid the U.S., right? But the extraordinary thing about it is last year, because there were national elections planned at the same time that the league was supposed to hold its tournament, they decided they couldn't hold the tournament in India. They literally decided, well, we can't do this in India. There were some security concerns, but the Indian government just wasn't willing to provide the security arrangements because they needed it for the elections. So they exported the whole thing to South Africa. And I was in South Africa at the time, and we all thought this was just a completely crazy idea to take the Indian Premier League, which does have international players. So the players are from all over the world. But still, these were Indian teams with Indian names. And the idea of and Bollywood stars and the idea that you could export this to South Africa just made no sense. And it was a total success. The South Africans loved it. The stadiums were full. I believe they made money. I'm not quite sure. But I do know in terms of popular enthusiasm in South Africa, they've never seen anything like it. And it was one of the few times that cricket actually attracted a multiracial crowd.
That's so fascinating and so full of meaning. I mean, if it does turn out to be the Indian century, cricket will turn out to be the global game. for sure. You know, in Joseph O'Neill's novel, Netherland, there's a cricket entrepreneur, wild and crazy guy from the Caribbean, actually, but his slogan is, think fantastic. Patrick Kelly, thank you enormously. And let's think fantastic and imagine the possibilities of India. Let's keep doing it. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.